This is Marketing Jam, a show featuring the brightest minds in marketing.
Brought to you by Canada Post. Head to canadapost.ca/insightpodcast for ideas to add value to your marketing.
Welcome to another episode of Marketing Jam. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to Canada Post for making this show possible. If you haven't subscribed to Insight Magazine and gotten one of those physical awesome magazines sent to your office or home yet, they are amazing, full of knowledge, ideas, and all sorts of inspiration of mail campaigns all around the world. Make sure to subscribe. Thank Canada Post for making this show possible. Well, without further ado, I want to welcome our guest today. This is actually a four-year-in-the-making dream come true. When we first started the show, Marketing Jam, we use a project management software at Jelly called Basecamp. And so we sought out to say, okay, think of all the software we use at Jelly and how do we get them as guests on our show? So it's been 4 years and worth the wait. So David, thank you so much for being on here. You are the CTO and co-founder of Basecamp. And a dream come true. So thank you so much for coming today. Well,
thank you so much for having me on, and thank you for being a Basecamp customer all along.
So why don't you give us some of the story of how it got started? I know a bit about it. You met Jason, you were helping him kind of develop it, and kind of where did it go from there?
Yeah, so I started working together with Jason Fried, my business partner at Basecamp, all the way back in 2001. When the company wasn't even called Basecamp, it was called 37 Signals. Yeah. And in 2001, it wasn't even a software company. It was a consulting company doing web design for clients. So I started working with Jason back in 2001 on a variety of consulting projects where I would do the programming, 37 Signals did the design. And then shortly thereafter, we started working on some internal projects together. The first thing we did was something called single file. Okay. So Jason in the 90s did some File Maker Pro apps for tracking like your book collection and your CD collection and so on. And he wanted to bring one of those apps to the web. So we took the book collection app and we brought it to the web, and it was called single file. And it was the first sort of product that we launched together. And it did sort of fine. There could probably have been a nice little business in that, but it didn't really take off. Then I think maybe 2 years later or something like that, we realized that we'd been working on these client projects together and things kept falling through the cracks. Mm. Like we would just do them over email and like someone would say something or they'd send the wrong file. It'd just be the mess that managing projects over email always turns into, right? Email is such a wonderful tool. And I mean, it's kind of funny. We're working on an email product now. So I have a lot of love for email. Mm-hmm. But organizing projects with multiple participants, multiple deliveries, it just always falls down. Yeah. And it falls down at the least opportune time always, right? Yeah. And you just go like, ah, shit. Yeah. So we went, do you know what? Hey, we know how to build software. Can't we do something that's just a little better than email? It doesn't have to be amazing, just a little better than email. And that's what became Basecamp. In 2003, we started working on Basecamp together. Just for ourselves, actually. The original pitch was, we just want to make a small little tool. It's basically like a blog plus the to-do list manager plus some file uploading and tracking on a calendar such that we can do all the stuff we need to do for the project. And we'll just do it for us. And then about halfway through, we realized, hey, this is nice. This is better. Maybe other people would be interested in it too. And we showed it to some people in the industry. Kudal Partners in Chicago was one of the first companies to use it as well. And they were like, hey, can I pay for this? And we were like, yes. And then in 2004, we released it. And it was a side project. I mean, we built it on the side. We had clients. And we essentially treated Basecamp like it was the third or the fourth client. And we did so for quite a while. It took over a year before Basecamp was doing well enough as a business to just pay the meager salaries of the four people at 37 Signals at the time. Yeah. But then we just stuck with it. And here we are, 16 years later, we're still doing Basecamp. We're on version 3. We've made a bunch of other products over the years and stopped selling some of them. And now we're working on a brand new product called Hey to do email. Wow. And in that whole time in the past, 20 years that I've been working with Jason, we've sort of, I guess what we'll talk about here, taken a kind of a slightly different approach to the marketing, that our number one approach is to outteach the competition rather than outspend the competition, which is the saying I got from Kathy Sierra back in the mid-2000s. And it always just stuck with me that we felt like we were learning so much building this business, doing the software we did, doing the design techniques we did, that, hey, we should share those. We've gotten so much, like our entire business is basically possible because there's a bunch of free software out there called open source software. And you get to use it for free, even if you're not, you don't have to be a big company, you don't have to sign licensing agreements. So our entire basis of our business is possible because there was just free stuff out there. And we thought like, hey, we got to return some of that and put it back into the system. And that's what we've done with blogging and conferences and podcasts. And, yeah, and we've written a couple of books and shared a bunch of our techniques of our own software and design. Probably the biggest one is Ruby on Rails.
Yep.
The web application toolkit that we extracted from Basecamp is also something we're still working on 16 years later. And it's been used on everything from GitHub to Shopify to Twitter to whatever. So that's the short history bringing us to 2020.
And to clarify, so you guys are would you say you're the creator of Ruby on Rails then? Is that the best way to put it?
Yeah. I mean, I wrote Ruby on Rails as the single programmer on Basecamp back in 2003. And then I open sourced it in late 2004 and sort of continued to spearhead that project and run that project. And now, of course, there's thousands and thousands of open source contributors who help make it better, and a bunch of companies that are really invested in it, like GitHub and Shopify and many others. And of course, like millions of applications that have been created with it. So
that's incredible. So we adopted Basecamp too in 2013 to run our entire agency. And you guys launched Basecamp 3, which we did not. We tried it for a bit, but we stuck to our 2, which, tell me, are we an unusual, are we an outlier? Is that a normal thing from what you've seen?
It's totally normal. And in my opinion, it's totally awesome.
Thank you.
So much of software, especially software as a service,
yeah,
people who make software, they always think the latest version is better for everyone all the time on their schedule.
Yeah.
And it never is. Yeah. There's so many times where you just, for whatever reason, you either like that version of the software because it does things differently, you're used to it, you've trained your people on it, it just works, right?
Yeah.
And I think so many software makers, they don't have the humility to think that the world does not revolve around their software, right? For a lot of companies, even if they like it, it's a fax machine. It's a nice fax machine, but you know what? The firmware upgrade is never timely. You're never like, oh, the thing I wanted to do was just rejig my entire process right now on your schedule. Now, that's not to say that, I mean, we're not proud of Basecamp 3. Obviously, we think it's the best version, but it's the best version for us. It's the best version for new customers.
Yeah.
And then we have a huge amount of our business is still running, not just on Basecamp 2, but the original classic version. We still run and operate the original classic version that was launched in 2004 that we stopped developed in 2009. So we have this major part of our business that's a piece of software that's 11 years old that has basically only been upgraded to deal with security issues or performance issues. And then we have Basecamp 2, and I love all those venues, right? Like, imagine if you're like a fan of the Leica camera, right?
Yeah
You like the Leica M6. It's a great camera, and Leica comes. Yep. Do you know what? That doesn't work anymore. You got to buy a digital M10 because that's the only thing we sell now. So throw out your M6 and do it right now, and throw out your darkroom and throw out all your stuff. People go like, "What? What are you talking about?"
Yeah.
So for me, it's really been a great source of pride that we've kept these versions of Basecamp around. Like, you look back at any other company, whether it's Leica, whether it's Porsche, whether it's Rolex, they have this legacy. And in software, legacy is a bad word, right? Like, it means old, it means kind of crappy. Why does it have to mean that? Couldn't it just mean a period of time where this was the best thing that you made, right? Like, I have a Rolex watch from 1972.
Wow.
I think that version of that watch, that's the best one. They made newer ones. They got better in all sorts of objective terms, perhaps, maybe more waterproof, or maybe they can go longer without a revision or something else. I don't care. I like the one from 72. That's one is awesome. Great, right? And I think, why can't we have that in software? especially when you have something like what we did for Basecamp was the different versions of Basecamp aren't just like, well, here's a new feature. Mm-hmm. We went, hey, let's redesign the whole thing from scratch. It's the same domain, but it's a completely different take on it, right? It's a different spin. And of course, there's going to be people who are like, you know what? I like this. I like spin number two. Do you think Leica is offended if someone says, like, I like the M6 and someone else says, I like the M5? No, they go like, isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
So that's the spiel on why we do it. And we've really encapsulated this actually into an entire operating principle. And we call it until the end of the internet.
Nice.
So that's how long we're going to continue to operate Basecamp 2 that you're on.
Thank you.
The end of the internet. And Basecamp Classic as well. And Basecamp 3, at some point we're going to come out with a Basecamp 4 perhaps. We've done a lot of other products over the years. We have a CRM tool called HiRise that we sold for a long time, but then we stopped selling it maybe 3 or 4 years ago because we just weren't improving it. And still, it's going to be around until the end of the internet.
That's awesome. So we, using Basecamp 2, we have sometimes we have to work with another agency on a project and some of them use Basecamp 3. And so we've been on there and it's great. Like the waves, the little bells, like it's awesome. But we found that like we have it structured, and this is how we structure Basecamp, especially for agencies that are listening, is that we invite everyone to the project, all of our staff, all of our clients. The clients are in a different kind of invitation world. And so we can hide things from the client and we can keep internal conversations going. But then it's so simple and our clients have adopted it. So you say it's not, the world doesn't revolve around your software. Well, our jelly world actually revolves around Basecamp. So all of our to-dos, our calendar, our weekly updates all go through Basecamp right now.
That's great. So what's interesting is that with Basecamp 3, the whole client model and how we did it, we changed it completely and we called it the client side.
Yeah.
And it was a bad idea. It didn't work. People didn't like it. Exactly what you described is what we went back to. So if you tried Basecamp 3 now, maybe you'd like it better because we actually went back to the Basecamp 2 model where everyone is on the same project and you can hide certain things that you don't want to share versus before we went like, maybe clients don't want to be all involved. And what we found was there was just a lot of clients. Yeah, they wanted to be involved. Like Basecamp was actually a value add for the relationship that it was better for them to be involved in a piece of software where they were on the same page. And we thought, do you know what? Because we had heard some stories, right? Like one of the most common reasons for why people stop using Basecamp is they say, I couldn't get others to use it with me.
Hmm.
And we went, oh, maybe that's specifically a problem with client services. Let's make it even easier. Let's make it such that the clients just deal with email. They don't have to get a login and all these other things. And for a few people, that was better. And for a lot of people, just like you explained, it was better. It was a little bit of a hurdle, perhaps sometimes, to get clients to learn a new system.
Oh, yes.
But once they do, they go like, this is better.
And they love it. It becomes their file storage. And then they adopt it in their own company. It's been incredible, the amount of stories of clients that now use Basecamp internally for accountability purposes, really.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this was where we got it wrong. And I think that's part of that humility, right? To think of sometimes you make a decision and you kind of luck out. Like you come up with a great design and you don't really know it's a great design until you try to redo it and you do it worse.
Yeah.
And then you go like, you know what? Actually, we had a good idea there. Maybe we should just go back to that. So we try to keep that humility that like, we're not always going to be right. And there's going to be great ideas in earlier versions of the software that are going to persevere. So we shouldn't be so quick to just pull it and yank the plug, right? The other thing there too is we've been on the receiving end of others yanking the plug, right? Like anyone who's used Google software knows that they seem to shut down software like every week. You just get used to using something and then like, all right, you can't use it anymore. We're actually dealing with this right now with HiRise, which has an integration with Gmail that allows it to send some email in a certain way. And Gmail just goes like, we don't want to do that anymore. And like stuff just starts breaking. And we go like, Jesus, this is why we want to do until the end of the internet. This is why we want to keep things around. This is why we want to let people stay on the version that they're happy with. And why not, right? Like the thing that's great about software as a service is as long as people keep paying you, that's the game on the commercial level, right? Like, do I really care whether people want to pay me for Basecamp 2 or for Basecamp 3? No, I don't. Yeah. Okay, so the other thing we've also done, learned a hard lesson is we've never raised prices on existing customers. So if you signed up for Basecamp in 2005 and you signed up for the $19 a month plan, you're paying $19 a month now.
We're still paying Yeah, we're still paying the same amount right now.
Exactly, because we just don't do that. And we go like, do you know what? Someone signed up and they made that leap of faith in and they committed to a platform. We're not just going to change it on them. Because that's the thing I really don't like about services in general. You feel like you put your data into it. You're kind of captive. And now someone just starts turning the screws on you. You're like, no, let's not do that. Let's just instead keep putting out our best work and charge market rates for that at that time. Yeah. And then everyone else, they're here because they're part of our legacy. We celebrate our legacy. We cherish our legacy. And it's all good.
It's quite funny. Talking to other agency owners that use other stuff, it's almost like there's it's like if you've read Harry Potter, it's like what school do you belong to, right? There's almost like a pride in like some people are like, well, I'm a sauna. And then they look you up and down like you're not an Asana user, right? Or you're not a Monday user. So it's like they assume certain personality traits about you or certain characteristics because you subscribe to that camp.
It's the same thing. We were talking about cameras, right? Like, are you a Leica shooter? Or are you a Canon shooter? Are you a Nikon shooter? Right? Like, there's all this sort of tribalism that's just innate in human nature, and we infer it on. Same thing with the cars. Like, oh, Porsche or whatever, an Audi or whatever else have you. There's brand loyalty is quite strong, and people end up adopting it sort of deep in their heart that, like, I am the kind of person who would buy a Leica. I am the kind of person who'd aspire to own a Porsche. Like that kind of stuff, which is, I always have sort of two ways about it, right? On the one hand, I'm a huge fan of some of these companies we were talking about, both Leica and Porsche, huge fan of that, Rolex as well, just in awe, right? And at the same time, I'm also like, you know what? I try to sort of not get sucked into it, right? Not sort of wrap my identity and my ego up in like, what do I buy and what do I use? Because that also doesn't feel great. But there's some place there in the middle where you like things you like because they're the kind of companies you want to associate with. They build the kind of products that you enjoy. And you can still keep it at some arm's length where they don't define who you are.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it makes sense. And sometimes I describe when people ask, like, what's the difference between the different project management systems? I'm like, well, if you're a Mac or a PC user, right? So I describe often Basecamp is more for Mac users because it's a little more like colorful, it's rounded edges, it's easy to use, it's intuitive. Where like Asana is more like using a PC, like there's a lot of systems and things to figure out. You have to learn, there's a learning curve to figuring it out, where Basecamp's kind of like turning on a MacBook. It just works.
I'm just going to record that and we're going to play that now as our advertising reel for Basecamp. I think it's very true that there just are, sometimes you just go like, the reason I like this product is because the people who built it, they thought like I would think, and therefore it's intuitive for me, right? Versus, and that's the thing about, I'm a Mac user as well. I've been a Mac user for a good 20 years. When I talk to PC users, or the same thing, iOS versus Android, right? Like there are people who just, their brain is wired in such a way that like Android or Windows just totally speaks for them. Like I want maximum sort of adjustability. I want to set things up and just sort of, I want to tinker. I want to, and I go like, that's amazing. Like we need that variety. And that's where we have to keep that in mind with the tribalism that naturally occurs, is that it's great to find your tribe. It feels like you find someone you belong to, you can connect to. It's really wonderful. You just got to keep in mind that like, people are wired differently, and then people in the other tribe, they are there a lot of the times because their brain simply just is routed differently. And when they see the world, they respond to something else. And that's what gives us sort of this diversity, which is why we've been so happy to be in this world with project management, because it's not a winner takes all. There's room for, I don't know, at this point, there's probably 100 different tools that does sort of something like what Basecamp does, right? Yeah. And we can all be there. We can all have our little tribe, because it doesn't end up being like a Facebook winner takes all or whatever, where there's these network effects that make it almost impossible for someone to offer an alternative. So offering products in that marketplace where we can simply compete on like, hey, we're putting a product out there. We explicitly say, this is not for everyone. Right. Yeah. Like there's going to be people who show up at our door at Basecamp and go like, does it do this? Does it do that? And we just going to, you know what? No, that's not the focus of it. And you'd be better off if you picked a different product.
Yeah.
And we could be okay with that. We don't need like 5% of any, whatever the world market for project management. We have enough and it's good. And we can focus on that group and we can make wonderful software for it. They're happy. We're happy. It's big enough. That's awesome. How the world should be.
We did a little hack here at Jelly on our Basecamp too. So how we do it, where every time we assign a project, we give it a 1, 2, 3, 4 before we describe the project title. If it's a 1, it's like, drop everything, you need to do it. This happens rarely, but it's like, drop everything, this is it. And it's a 2 is like, this is a real deadline. Like, the date that we've assigned is real. A 3 is, hey, this would be nice to do. This would be nice to do. And a 4 is like back burner. Like, think about doing something like this. That's kind of our own internal ways that we've made Basecamp even better for us. Yes. And even communicate really clear expectations to our staff and our coworkers.
I love it. It was the thing that we used to talk about that more, this idea that like you build your own conventions. You build like your own dialect of the software. You put in like little tweak. You know what that means, right?
Yeah.
And that's how you get to change the software and how it works for you, even though you can't reprogram it, right?
Yeah.
And I think that that's, a lot of people look at that and they go like, that's bad. Like, it means that the software wasn't sort of well-designed. No, it means that it's more flexible, right?
Yeah.
Because one of the things when we started with Basecamp, we started building Basecamp specifically for client services firms, right? Because that's who we were, that's what we knew, right?
Yeah.
But we didn't build it in such an explicit way that like the whole language was about that, which was how we then ended up like learning, oh, all of a sudden this church signed up.
Yeah.
All of a sudden this other organization signed up. And we learned that a bunch of people found use out of Basecamp exactly because it wasn't overly specified, right?
Yeah.
Overly specialized. And that's also part of what makes it easier to use. When there's this deep vernacular you have to learn because it's sort of deep in the trade of a certain industry, it just raises the bar. And I think especially for client services firms where you got to get a client up and running pretty quickly, you can't spend 20 hours teaching them how to use the system. They pretty much just have to get it as soon as they get the login. Otherwise, it's not going to work. That's really a powerful, powerful approach.
Now, David, you wrote a book. You have a book out. Tell us about it. Tell us about the book and why you wrote that.
Yes. So we've actually written 4 books, Jason and I, over the years. But the latest one is called It Doesn't Have to Be Crazy at Work.
Yeah.
Which is funny because at first we were going to call it The Calm Company, which kind of we had an internal competition at Basecamp for designing the cover.
Yeah.
And The Calm Company was the working title for it. And all the applications for that cover were all about like these Zen circles and people sitting quiet and whatever. And we went like, hey, that's really nice. But you know what? That's not the argument we're making. We're far more aggressive. So that's how we ended up. It doesn't have to be crazy at work, because we're making an argument, an aggressive argument actually, for why the way most companies today are structured is just harmful. Actually, for human beings, for the soul of working people, that we don't need to configure our companies in this way. And this goes all the way from how we spend our time to what are our ambitions. In software, which is really the domain we know the best, there's a default assumption that everyone wants to be a unicorn. Everyone wants to be a billion-dollar company, and they want to sort of preferably get there in like 3 years, right? Like overnight. And that's not us. That's not who we wanted. Like, one of the chapters in the book is called Our Goals, No Goals.
Yeah.
Like, there's not this, like, we don't have to just manically grow. We don't have to get to sort of this big moment where we go public or whatever else it is. We're really happy where we are. Like, we run a company of 56 people.
Yeah.
That's a great size.
Yeah.
Jason and I have both sort of decided, like, that's around the size that we like. I wouldn't want to run a company of 300 or 3,000 or 30,000, because then my job would be totally different.
Yeah.
And just even putting some of that out there of how we think about ambition, how we think about aspiration, and that it's okay to say stop. Not only is it okay, it's actually in many ways better. One of the other sayings we have is, like, small is not a stepping stone. Like, a small company, a medium-sized company, is not just like on the road to become like a huge company, and they like haven't made it until they've arrived there. They can totally and authentically just say, like, you know what? This company of 10 people, that's a great place to be. In many ways, when I think of our company of 56, I think back of when we were 15, and I have smiles on my face.
Yeah.
Right? Like, a lot of people do that. This was actually how we arrived at some of these conclusions in the book. We're talking to other entrepreneurs and reminiscing about the quote-unquote good times, right? Like, the times where they enjoyed the business the most.
Yeah.
And a lot of entrepreneurs who were now responsible for hundreds or thousands of people would think back with such sort of a sparkle in their eye for like, oh, when we were 20 people, remember that? Remember when I was doing the work? Remember? And we went like, hey, we could just stop at the sparkle. Like, yeah. Why move past the sparkle? So that's one of the big themes of the book, is to reset. What do business objectives mean? What are business goals? You don't have to just adopt what is on the cover of some magazine or some aspiration that are being handed down to you. You can find other aspirations that are closer to what's actually true for you.
Yeah.
The second part of that, which is just as important, is a diagnosis of how we spend our time.
Mm.
And the diagnosis is a harsh one. We generally think that we spend our time very poorly. And that is a key root source of discontent and just misery at a lot of companies. So many companies today, for example, do not allow their workers to do the deep, careful, diligent, creative work that requires multiple hours of uninterrupted time.
Mm.
Right. They'll take the workday and then they'll slice it up into these tiny little work moments. Mm-hmm. Hey, you get an hour and a half here. You get 40 minutes there. And in between all of that stuff is mandatory meetings or other sort of impositions put on your calendar that makes it impossible for you to string together the time to really dive deep, to get into the flow, to do the creative work you really want to do that kind of work that is truly satisfying, where when you close the laptop at the end of the day, you go like, do you know what? That was a good day's work.
Mm.
And when you close the laptop at the end of the week, you look back with satisfaction of all the things you've accomplished. I think there's so many creative workers today who get trapped in habits and procedures where when they look back at the week, at the end of the week, they're like, What did I actually get done this week? And there's just a deep gnawing sense of discontent from that. That I think most creative people are, and I'm speaking mostly for myself here, but extrapolating, but they're kind of wired to feel good about creating.
Yes.
And when we're kind of hampered in that creative expression, we grow sully. Right. Yeah. Like we kind of get a little shitty and it just doesn't feel right. And I think that that's one of the big sort of scams of the modern office is that it makes us feel like though we're working, even though we're making no progress so much of the time. Right. One of the things we argue about is, as I say, cutting up the day into work moments. Something else is just the work environment. It's become very hip for last, 15, 20 years, the open office. Right.
Yeah.
This is the modern office. This is how we create. You look at all the studies about how concentration work and how collaboration actually works. And the open office is just terrible on all the metrics. It looks great.
Yeah.
Right. It looks really good. It's cheaper to build. It's more flexible in many ways when you sort of maybe you go from 8 employees to 12 employees or whatever up and down. It is more flexible, but it's not good for work. It is not good for sort of that deep creative work. It may be good for certain kinds of work. The people I mostly hear who are very happy with it are either salespeople or executives. People who don't need 2, 3, 4 hours of uninterrupted time to do their work, that's all running on an interrupt schedule. They're usually fine with it. But when you talk to people who do that creative work and need the uninterrupted time, a lot of them are seriously discontent with the setup. So that's one of these other things and why we've embraced remote work at Basecamp and not just for the current pandemic, but that's how we've been operating for the past 20 years.
Yeah.
Giving employees the opportunity to live where they want to live and work in the way that feels good to them. Now, that doesn't mean that everyone just works from their own sort of spare bedroom. We have plenty of people who actually like the energy of other people.
Yeah, yeah.
So some people occasionally they'll go to a coffee shop, they'll go somewhere else or a co-working location, maybe a couple of days a week, maybe on their own schedule. We force no one into the office and we let people find where they want to work. And it also gives us sort of the freedom and flexibility to hire people from wherever.
Yeah.
So Basecamp and 37 Signals before it is a Chicago company. It was founded in Chicago. If we could only have hired within, let's say, 45 minutes commute distance of the Chicago office, we would have looked at a very small talent pool compared to the, 600, 700 million people we looked at when we hire between mainly the US, Canada, and Europe. Which is like, why?
Yeah.
Right? So these are some of the themes that we go over in the book, trying to reshape the aspirations of the modern business and the configuration of the modern business and arrive at a place where more people can do the kind of work that leaves a deep mark of life satisfaction on their soul. And they can keep doing it for year after year after year. And that sense of long-term satisfaction, both with the people you work with and the way you work, it has just been such a monumental influence on our lives that we're like, more people should do this. More people should work like this. And we can perhaps share some tips, tricks, and inspiration of how to do it and how to get there that we've picked up over the past 20 years.
So, David, I got to ask, I want to quote something from you where you talked about Zoom and Tetris. And,
yes.
And so I've heard the term inbox zero.
Yep.
You used the term called calendar zero.
Yep.
But that was, and you, but you referenced Zoom as Zoom's attempt to fill your calendar like a Tetris box. Fill it
yes.
with it. Explain
yes.
that to me.
Yeah, so that's the game of calendar Tetris. If you look at a modern calendar today, it's all these little blocks. They all have these little different shapes and colors. They
yes.
look very much like a Tetris board. And for a lot of employees, they end up with essentially a full board.
Yes.
All hours are spoken for. And if
yeah.
there's an open time,
yeah.
someone can just come in and grab it.
Yeah.
They can just take it, right? So that's one of the things one of the chapters in the book is called Calendar Tetris. And we talk about how we don't have open calendars at Basecamp.
No.
I can't see what's on Jason's calendar.
Yeah.
If I want to book some time with Jason,
yeah.
it is a manual process that's kind yeah. of a pain in the ass.
Yeah. But
where I ask him like, hey, are you free Friday at 10? And he says, no, but maybe we could do Monday at 2.
Yeah.
Right? Like it's this manual ping pong back and forth, which just gets exponentially more difficult the more people you want to involve.
Yeah.
If you want to do the manual ping pong with 8 people, it's a real pain in the ass.
Oh yeah.
So do you know what happens? We don't do it. We don't do the manual ping pong with 8 people because it's such a pain in the ass
yeah.
that usually our meetings are capped out when like 3 or 4 people are there
yeah.
because any more than that is just too much of a hassle to organize. And that's the kind of procedural vinegar
yeah.
we want. We want it to be difficult. We want friction.
Yeah.
So much of modern software today is constructed on the notion that all friction is bad and
yeah.
all friction should be erased.
Yeah, yeah.
When you think of protecting someone's time, you want barriers. You
yeah.
want it to be hard, right? Because the thing that happens in an office when the calendar is free, someone can just take your time. And the
yeah.
amount of social capital you have to expend to reject that,
yeah,
it's just way too high. People don't do it. So what they do instead is they come up with all these weird self-defense techniques. I've heard all sorts of things. They try to fill their own calendar Tetris blocks out with like fake events, or they book their own time, right? Just so someone else can't
yeah.
steal it
That's
from them.
Hilarious.
And we just think like, do you know what? That's not good. You could just not do that. You could make your calendar not be public. And do you know what you'll end up with? A calendar with far less things on it. Like I tweeted just the other day, like I opened up my iPhone in the morning
yeah.
and like, oh, the events for the day, nothing planned. And I went, hallelujah, this is a wonderful day. What a great start that I see. I have no meetings or anything planned on it whatsoever. And now I can just get on with the work. Now, that's not to say that that's how it can always be. You can't collaborate with 56 people for a year and never
yeah.
talk or see anyone, nor would it be good.
No.
This is more about getting back into some balance here, that
yeah.
most of the time work should be about doing the work, and a little bit of the time the work should be about coordinating and planning the work, right? But more of the time, we just need to pick a plan. This is why at Basecamp, we have this clock frequency
yeah.
that runs on 6-week cycles.
Okay.
So we essentially, every 6 weeks,
yeah.
we pause for a week or sometimes yep. 2 weeks, and we call that cool down. That's when we assess what did we get done in the past
yeah.
6 weeks and what should we do for the next 6. And we make that determination, like here's what we want to work on for the next 6 weeks. The hope is that like we made that determination now, and now we will shut up about
mm-hmm.
what to work on for the next 6 weeks because we made the plan, right? So let's just do the work. And then in another 6 weeks, we can talk again about, hey, maybe we want to do this or we want to do that. But this idea that you're constantly discussing and moving around the work pieces,
yeah.
I don't think it's good. It's not healthy. It looks like it's collaboration. It
yeah.
looks like it's fluid. It looks like
yeah.
it's all these things. But the end result is that people end up just being frazzled and
yeah.
wishing, can you just decide what it is? and give me 5 minutes. Can you give me 5 minutes to just do the work and not interrupt me again about doing something else? Now, not all work is like this, and something is interrupt based. We have customer support people, we have operation people, things pop up and stuff happens. But a lot of the work is like this. A lot of the work is project based work where you could plan it better so that it's not entirely interleaved. People don't multitask. That's a complete misnomer. They shift from tasks to tasks. Yeah. And every time they shift, there's time to wind down and there's time to wind up. There's huge transaction costs between jumping back and forth these things. So a key way to get the productivity and get the satisfaction that comes from that productivity is simply to say, we're not going to switch tasks for like 2 weeks.
Wow.
You work on this one thing for 2 weeks and I'll leave you the fuck alone.
Yeah.
And you'll tell me at the end of the 2 weeks whether we're there and if it's good, right?
Yeah. That's awesome. So, David, I can assume you're not going to be adopting Calendly anytime soon in your email signature?
God, no. It's funny.
It's a trend. In the last month, I've been given Calendly 4 or 5 times saying, if you want, like, they're trying to meet with me. And they're saying, book it in my Calendly. And I'm like, really? I have to go into Calendly?
It's such a fascinating dynamic because to me it's profoundly rude to ask like I want to meet with you but hey you go pick in my litter box of open times where you can find some trash to jam it into. That's just a weird social dynamic. Hey, I'd really like to meet with you. Hey, here's my calendar. You figure it out.
Yeah.
Like, what? Like how is that even a thing, right? And then the second thing is this idea that any time of the day I'm free is a good time to meet. Like. Yeah. Most days, do you know what? I'm not free at any hour.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I'm working.
Yeah.
Like, this grand open space that you see as just empty on the Tetris block, it's not empty. There's work there. That's where I do the work. So I try to set up my things. For example, this call. I set up calls at very specific times in the morning.
Yeah.
Usually around 9:30 to 10 a.m. Pacific time. Because after lunch, I want to just work. Like, I don't want to have that peppered with all this other stuff in there, right? Like, I need to get all that stuff out in the morning. That's where I do a lot of my coordination and my calls. It's Calendly is such a... I don't like it. I don't like it. And I don't like email footers either. It was funny. I was just having this discussion on Twitter. We're building this Hey.com client and service for email. And someone was asking me, what are you going to do about all these footers? Like, I keep getting these things that they're 3 pages long of like, hey, don't print this out. And this is confidential. And like, here's my 15 addresses and 200 phone numbers you can call me on. Like, how do we get rid of that, right? And my answer was in part, like, we're going to start by being the change we want to see. So in the personal version of our email service, hey.com, there's no signature. You literally cannot put it in.
Yeah.
And we're not going to fill in the crap with like us saying sent by hey or sent by superhuman or sent by my iPhone. No, nothing. Do you know what? Emails already have your name on them.
Yeah.
They already have the subject. We don't need to fill the body with all this other crap. And then when we come to the business version, it was funny. Originally, we had made the pledge. There's just not going to be any signatures in hey.com, right? And then we heard from some people in Europe and we're like, oh, it's actually a legal requirement in Germany and several other places that you have to have certain pieces of company information in your footer. But even so, your footer doesn't have to be 5 times as long as your actual email, right?
Yeah.
So no, we're not going to have any calendar links in there or hopefully almost anything else either.
And timeline for when kind of we can check out Hey or where can we go for updates on Hey?
Yeah. hey.com. We have a short spiel of the sort of the problem statement.
Yeah.
Not too much yet about what the product actually is, but we define what we see the problem to be, which I always think is a step that some people just they take it for granted or they skip over it. They don't want to do essentially the analysis of what they're trying to solve. They just jump straight into let's build some features.
Yeah.
Features are great, but unless you have sort of a cohesive vision for why you're trying to build something new, there's a million email clients out there. There's a million email services. Like, why should someone give us a second look? Well, our opinion is because we have a different diagnosis of what's wrong with email and why it's broken and how we can turn it into something people no longer loathe, but they might actually like or dare I say it, even love, right? Like, I think email is one of the greatest software sort of protocols of all time, but it's been sullied by abuse, neglect, and all these other things. So we try to sort of spell that out, and the problem statement is on hey.com. And then the product itself, we were going to launch it this month.
Oh, okay.
It was going to be out this month, and we had geared up with sort of like our campaign for that. We'd started sort of seeding it, and boom, the world gets smack hit with this pandemic. And we go, you know what? Now is not a good time. We have a bunch of employees who are scrambling to make a new situation work for them. They all of a sudden, they have their kids at home and their spouses at home. And like, it's a new situation. No one's going to work like a full 40 hours.
Yeah.
Right. And no one is going to feel like they have that extra capacity to deal with the stress that is launching a new service. Yeah. So we're just going to hit pause.
Okay.
It's not great. We had geared everything up for it. We were ready to launch. But you know what? It was more important that like the team that we have, they feel good about what we're doing, right? Okay. And the key realization there was almost all deadlines are made up.
Yeah.
We act as though they're not, but they are. They're humans setting down and say, like, you know what? Like Friday the 15th, that would be a great day to launch. And it's just like we pulled it out of somewhere, right? Like very rarely out of facts or whatever. They're aspirational. And then we forget that we actually came up with them and we think they're etched into stone and that we must meet those deadlines come hell or high water. Yeah. And we just went, no, we don't. We can just move the stone. We can just etch that out.
I wonder if there's an international email day and you could launch it on that day. That would be the only one you'd really kind of...
I would be into that. What we've done for now is we punted it out.
Yeah.
Hopefully we're going to launch it sort of soonish.
Yeah.
Things have calmed down a bit. I think when the pandemic first started, we were like, it was just so crazy, so much crazy in such a short amount of time. We were all scrambling. We were like, I have no idea. Like, is it going to be 2 months from now? Is it going to be 6 months from now? What is it going to be? Right.
Yeah.
And I think perhaps been a little encouraged by the fact that at least at Basecamp, for most of the people who work at Basecamp, things have gotten a little more normal, perhaps even a little sooner than we thought. Like,
well, you guys wrote the textbook on remote work.
Yes. So we were ready for the work part because we were already working like that. So that wasn't the difficult. It was the life part that was hard.
Yeah.
And I think what we've just realized was humans adapt quite well to harsh circumstances.
Yeah.
And anyone who's now have to find a new routine with perhaps kids and a spouse at home and all that comes with that, after like we just started at our home week 7 of the quarantine, you kind of get into a hang of things. It's perhaps not the same thing, but like you get into a rhythm, right? And we've gotten into that rhythm for most people at Basecamp. And now we're more ready to think of like, okay, we're going to do this. So we started showing it to a few people and I hope that... I hope we're closer. We said April, right? And we were sort of like, it was in the banners, it was everything. So now I'm like, we're not going to say like X. And then we get to X and like either the pandemic goes back up or something else happens. We're just going to hold off until we're like right before ready to go. Because giving two dates that you punt on like that, that's not good, good manners. So we won't do that.
So I got to ask you, dad to dad. David, what's your, and being someone that wrote the book on remote work, what's your advice for dads that are just starting to do remote work?
That's a good question.
Because I think
for any parent who's thrown into this, who were not on this and they had a routine that involved like going to an office and like being away from the kids for a certain amount of time, first accept that like you're not going to get it on like day one or week two. Right. Like it takes some time to, first of all, acclimate to the new situation, then develop the habits and the practices to make this work. We think so oftentimes that remote is just like it's work, but in your home.
Yeah.
That's not quite the case. Right. Like there are some sort of tools and techniques that you can employ to make remote work feel better for you.
Yeah.
To work better with your team and in your company. And that takes a little time to learn that stuff. That's why we, in 2013, the year you adopted Basecamp, we wrote a book called Remote Office Not Required that went over like what we had learned by, at that point, I think like 12 or 13 years of working remotely. And there's just some of these tricks of how to create the separation. One of the fears a lot of managers have with remote work is like, oh, if they're working from home, I can't see them. Maybe they're just goofing off. Maybe they're just doing PlayStation all day or folding laundry. And it turns out that the number one problem is the opposite, that people end up working too much.
Yeah.
When there's no clear separation between home and work, they end up answering emails at 8 o'clock at night because like, hey, it's just a laptop and it's there and it's a thing, right? So when we keep having to do with new employees that come into Basecamp who worked in an office is we keep having to tell them to pace it. Like, no. You got to shut the laptop at five. Like, once you work 8 hours, that's enough. Like, there's not bonus points here for trying to push in 10 or 12 or whatever. In fact, it ends up just biting you to do that, right? Because you can do that for a little while. You can sprint for a little while. But eventually you get exhausted, and then the recovery is so much longer. We just go like, I am so uninterested in how much work someone can get done in 2 weeks. I don't care. I care what someone can get done in 3 months.
So here's the question. In France, I don't know if you have any employees in France, but doesn't the country of France have it where email doesn't even work after a certain time?
There's a law both in France and I think also in Germany now, where employees are essentially by law enshrined not to have the obligation to check work email. And I love it. I absolutely love it. I wish we would do that here too. We tried to do the small version of this in Basecamp 3. There's a feature called Work Can Wait.
Yeah.
It essentially sets up a schedule during which you will receive notifications. Yeah. Outside of that schedule, no notifications. I think that's one of the other problems we have is the consumerization of all our corporate tooling means that we now use the same devices for home and work. I have one iPhone, right? Like I don't have a work iPhone and a home iPhone. Yeah. And if I have a work iPhone and like all the notifications just keep piling in, do you know what? That's not great. And it's you can keep saying as a company, well, no, you don't have to worry about it. But humans are just curious beasts, right? Like there's a notification and it's a client and they say they need something. So you check it out and you respond right there, even if it is 9 o'clock and you were supposed to read bedtime stories to your son or your daughter. And you go like, that's not a great dynamic. We need to deal with a structural problem in a structural way. We can't just leave it up to kind of the reserves of individual parents to deal with this. There's all these weird pressures of like, if my boss emails me on Sunday at noon, am I supposed to answer? Can I wait until Monday? Right? There's all these things. So I think it's to get good as a new parent at working remotely from home, you got to think of it. This is a new skill. I got to learn this. I got to set up some new sustainable habits. And then I got to realize that like I'm just an individual and we need to do the work as a whole company.
Yeah.
So you can do a lot of work on your own, but it is so much more effective if you can get the buy-in from the company that like, hey, we're treating this seriously. We're going to do it in a way where it doesn't feel like it's just overwhelming you and taxing you or even worse, some of the things I've seen the last few days are absolutely making my skin crawl, where employers are installing essentially spyware on their employee machines such that they take like screenshots of the desktop or with the webcam or something to ensure that people are working. I just go like, oh man, this is exposing some of these tendencies that were always like just under the surface, right? Like the mistrust and whatever else. And then it's bubbling it up. So I'd say to anyone starting to work from home, hopefully you don't work from a company like that. If you do, realize that this is not normal. It doesn't have to be that way. And if you're being subjected to these kinds of invasive surveillance techniques, maybe you bite your tongue right now because it's not a good time. But you start looking for somewhere else to work as soon as things get back to a way where you can.
Yeah.
And then I think the other thing is to realize a lot of proponents of remote work, me included, we talk about all the happy things about remote work. Oh, there's the productivity, the control of your environment, the lack of a commute. Yeah. Your kids are right there. And like, those are all true, but they're going to feel a little less true right now because you didn't choose.
Yes.
You were forced to.
Yeah.
You were forced to work remotely and you're forced to adapt to this. So all these benefits can seem a little not like they're benefits. And what you see is you see the drawbacks. Well, now all of a sudden I have to figure out how to set up my computer in such a way that at work it was just all set up for me. Or how do I deal with the separation? Maybe I don't have two spare bedrooms and we're two people at home who have to work and we have to share and that feels awkward. And there are all these other things where know that that is happening. You're not doing this just because you want to. You're doing this because you have to.
Yeah.
And then hopefully over time, you're going to find a rhythm. It's just like anything, right? Like we started homeschooling with our oldest, right? And the first day of homeschooling, you just go like, the head just explodes. And you're like, how is this ever going to work?
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? Already on day two, it's a little less head exploding. Mm-hmm. Like it's so disorienting and it's so frustrating, like right when you start. And then you do it for a week. or you do it for 2 weeks, and you get used to sort of the drawbacks, or you accommodate to them, then you can start appreciating the things that are actually better. Oh yeah, actually not spending an hour and a half driving in a tin box back and forth to an office. Yeah. It's pretty great. I have that time now. Hey, spending my lunch with my kids?
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, I'm curious to see how many and what percentage of people will fight to retain the work from home world once people have the option to go back to the office. I'm very curious to see the numbers on that.
I would be very surprised if they're not quite high. What we found at Basecamp is a very substantial number of the people who worked for Basecamp say they would not go back to an office.
Yeah.
Like, it's just not an option anymore. Like, they've configured their life in such a way where remote work is just a baseline requirement.
Yeah.
So if they were to leave Basecamp, it's going to be for another remote opportunity, right?
Yeah.
And some people, they come to that a little slowly. Again, as we say, don't expect that you're going to love it. If you weren't doing it before and then all of a sudden you have to do it, like, you're not going to love it on week one. It just isn't going to happen. It's going to be too disoriented. There's too much to learn. But by a month into it or two months into it, you can at least, I think, appreciate the nice parts of it. And then also still realize that, like, it still isn't for everyone.
Yeah.
If you're, for example, you're a very extroverted person,
yeah,
you live maybe alone, and you're like, you just go stir crazy, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's, there's a reason why sort of isolation is considered sort of a form of torture, right? Like, if you get put in solitary confinement somewhere, the UN shows up and says, like, do you know what? This is a version of torture. And for some people, surely it feels like that, right? If you're sort of single, and even if you're not, right? But the less human interaction you have during your day naturally, right? In our household, there's three kids, two adults, right?
Yeah.
I get a lot of social stimulation, probably in some days more than I can even handle it. But I'm also an introvert, so my bar is lower. I don't need any of the extra stuff, right?
Yeah.
But you know what? When I was, I don't know, in my 20s and single, whatever, I probably did, right?
Yeah.
Because as we've heard from people, like, you don't leave your house because, like, you don't want to, and you don't see other humans. And video chat is just, it feels like it's just as good. And in some ways, it is from a purely productivity perspective. I don't at all subscribe to this idea that, like, the magic only happens when we're around the whiteboard together. I think that's all bullshit.
Yeah.
When it comes to the work. But when it comes to the human connection, there's absolutely truth to it. And I think a bunch of articles have been popping up lately about how just exhausting it is to be on video calls all day.
Man.
And it is.
Yeah, because, Zoom exhaustion.
Yes, Zoom exhaustion, right? Because it's not the same thing as being there in person.
No.
Even for introverts, there's something engaging about being like 3 feet away from another human being in 3D, moving and all the things, right? And I think that that is often sort of missed, because a lot of companies, they don't want to talk like that. They want to talk about, like, oh, well, it's about productivity, it's about all these other things. No, it's about the human connections. And some people are going to miss that more than others.
Yeah.
And some people are going to go, like, do you know what? I'm not going to go back into that deprivation cell, voluntary.
Yeah.
Get me back to an office.
My friend is at Zapier, and he works just down the road from me here, but I don't know where headquarters is for Zapier, but he loves it. And I think it's once or twice a year, they get everyone together physically, and he introduced me to these cool things he was learning from his coworkers all around the world. And it's such an incredible story he tells me of the level of staff they get, the level of engagement. And they have those times, right, when they meet up once a year to see each other physically. And
so do we. Twice a year at Basecamp, we fly everyone into Chicago, and we spend a week together where the main focus is replenishing human connections,
amazing,
not productivity, not work. We do some of that too, but we also do plenty of board games, and we go out to eat, and we do all these other things just to, like, sort of recharge that battery, recharge the social battery. And that really is important. And it was one of the things, we were going to have our meetup here in April in Chicago.
Oh.
We had everyone lined up. They'd already bought their tickets.
Yeah.
We were going to have the meetup, and then we were going to launch Hey together.
Yeah.
Right?
Aww.
And like, oh man, bummer. That wasn't going to happen. Hopefully now I'm just hoping that we can have our fall meetup. We usually have spring and we have fall.
Yeah.
But we'll see. And I mean, I miss that too. Like, I'm very much an introvert. I very much like to sitting in my own office, but I can't do that for years on end. I still, every human needs some human connection. So that's just important. Focus that exclusively. One of the things we do at Basecamp right now is on Fridays, 10 a.m.
Yeah.
It's game time for an hour. Anyone could show up on this video conference and call.
Yeah.
They just play games for an hour in the middle of workday.
Jackbox, or are you guys using some sort of Steam?
I think they're actually mostly playing tabletop games or something like that.
Okay, cool.
And I think it's just one of those things where, like, you know what? The point isn't the work. The point is just that, like, hey, out of 40 hours, you can take an hour, you can take 2 hours, you can take a little time to just be a human with other humans. And you know what? That's also good for productivity. That's not because that's the purpose, but because healthy, happy, mentally sort of well-nourished people, they're just better workers. They're more productive workers. And it's just a nice human experience.
So, David, I got to ask, so those that are hearing about Basecamp, curious about maybe switching from their project management system or wanting to adopt a project management system, what are they going to experience when they go to Basecamp's website right now? Because I'm a longtime user, so I haven't, you know, adopted one in a long time. Is three the only option right now?
Three is the one we have in the front of the store for sale.
Yes.
If you write support and you say, like, hey, the guys at the Jelly told me to get Basecamp 2.
No, it's okay.
We're going to sell you Basecamp 2. You can get Basecamp 2 if you wanted to. Basecamp 3, I mean, if you haven't already used Basecamp, I'd say have a look at that. That's our freshest, newest work. Yeah. We're kind of billing it right now as the all-in-one toolkit for working remotely because that is, we saw a huge surge in the companies that wanted to figure something out because all of a sudden they were forced to work remotely, and Basecamp really makes that a whole lot easier. And then what they'll find is just this this one package to do all the work, to do the communication, to track the work, to follow up on the work, to ensure that nothing falls through the cracks, a place to invite their clients if they have that to come collaborate with them, where all the files are always up to date and the latest version. And then it's also, I mean, as dare I say it myself, pretty affordable. We have a one price. It's $99 a month, no matter how many people you have on it, no matter how many clients you involve. It's got all the space you'd possibly need. That's it. Everyone pays $99. In fact, we actually even have a completely free version now called Basecamp Personal that if you just have three people that are collaborating or fewer on three projects, we'll give it to you for free. Hopefully, I mean, you start using it, you like it, and then you want to use the paid version. So that's kind of the pitch, all in one place, not all over the place.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, David, it's been a real honor, a dream come true. Thank you so much for giving so much of your time to our listeners, our viewers. It's been a real honor to have you on the show. And our company revolves around your product. And I'm thankful to hear that it's not going away anytime soon, even though it's an older legacy version. I love your story of legacy. And, you know, I think there is a value to record players and records and antiques and things that just last. And I feel like we found an amazing product and tool that just works, and it's strong, and it's what we need. And so thank you for believing in that.
It'll be here tomorrow. It'll be here 10 years from now, and hopefully even 30 years from now. I love this idea that, like, you could be running 50-year-old software because you like that. You like your M6.
That's awesome.
It does what you need, and it takes sort of the pictures that you want, and it does the collaboration you need. Boom, we're going to be here for you.
And the book on working remote and work world doesn't have to be crazy. Both those are available on Amazon, correct? Kindle?
Everywhere you can find them on basecamp.com/books. We have an inventory of all of them. It doesn't have to be crazy at work. Remote office not required and rework. And we even have a couple of free books. We detail how we do software development. It's a process called Shape Up. It's a completely free ebook. It's you can find it also on basecamp.com/books. We have our old book, Getting Real, which was the book we wrote in 2006 on what it was like to create Basecamp and how to start a software company, also available totally for free. Outteach, not outspend.
Wow. And what do you call yourself? Is it the father of Ruby on Rails or the create?
I say creator because, like, I started it. I made the initial sort of extraction. But at this point, I mean, I'm perhaps just Rails' biggest fan. I mean, I still do some of the programming myself on new versions, but there are literally thousands of collaborators and contributors on it too. RubyOnRails.org is where you found all about that. And then for me personally, I am pretty much only on one sort of social platform. That's Twitter. At DHH, which is sort of perhaps an acquired taste of a feed. I would mix that feed up liberally with I don't know, kitty accounts or something else more positive on the world, because it's almost like my online spleen. There's usually things I'm upset about up there. So if that's your jam, then that's good.
That's awesome. Well, David, thank you again.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us this week on Marketing Jam, and we'll see you next time on The Jam.
Thanks for listening to Marketing Jam. If you enjoyed the show, head over to our YouTube or Facebook and give us a thumbs up, and visit iTunes to leave a rating and review. Thanks again, and see you next time.